The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
This is a difficult topic, to say the least. I think we entitled this Order and Disorder, question of the disengagement plan and the issue of refusing orders, particularly in the Israeli army. In almost 10 years at Israelite, I think pretty much I've succeeded in never going out on a political limb. Israelite has never been about politics. In fact, one of the things I love about Israelite, and I think this is true for the KJ beginner programs as well, you know, when you take a political stance, you inevitably align yourself with one group and distance yourself from another. And at an educational level, politics have always been symptoms, and we've always been more focused on the things that bring us together than the things that divide us. But I have to say that on this issue, tonight, for the first time, I'm going to make an exception. And I understand that security was checking for tomatoes at the door, and I hope nobody snuck any in. Statistically speaking, someone here will disagree with me tonight, which is always exciting as a rabbi. You're not having fun until someone really disagrees with you. And because of that, we're going to leave some time at the end for questions and answers, or at least for questions. Why is this order, is this topic, such a challenging topic? What about this issue makes it so central? I mean, this is not a new issue. And maybe just by way of introduction, I want to read to you two things that I got in my mailbox in Israel. The first, and these, as you can imagine, represent two different sides of this coin, right? And they came, interestingly enough, on the same day. I don't know if it was planned that way or just God has a good sense of humor. This is a picture of a soldier holding a Bible. Every Israeli soldier is sworn into the Israeli army and given a Tanakh. It used to be that different units went to different places in Israel. I was in Shiryan in the Armored Corps, and the Armored Corps used to go up in Masada. It's hard to describe what an incredibly intense experience it is to be standing beneath the night sky and to be sworn into the Israeli army in a place like Masada after 2,000 years. And they give you a Bible, and you hold the Tanakh, which I still have, and I use it to this day to teach with, and you hold it in your hand, and the general walks up to the platform, and he gives you a short speech. And every Israeli soldier hears the same speech. It's a text that was put together by the Israeli army rabbinate almost immediately after the rise of the state of Israel. And they quote from the book of Yoshua. Hinchem ovrim hayom et ha'Yarden hazeh. Today you are crossing over this Jordan. And Joshua has this unique moment in Jewish history. He will give the last words of inspiration to a people that are about to cross over into the land of Israel, to change destiny. And he recounts to them the history of their people, and they read you a few of these verses. And you stand there, and it suddenly hits you that for the first time in 2,000 years, the issues that were just existential, theological, in the possibility, are now reality. And playing on that emotion, Chayal Yakar, dear soldier, Barega shetkabel et hapkuda habilti chukit ba'alil, in the moment that you will receive the completely illegal order, laharos ulachriv et Eretz Israel, to destroy and lay waste or ruin to the land of Israel, ulaafsher b'mo yadecha, and to allow with your own hands, את הקמתו של מרכז הטרור הגדול ביותר בעולם, the rise of the greatest terror center in the world, ברגע שתקבל את פקודת הטרנספר, when you receive the order to transfer, particularly to transfer Jews from Gush Katif, from Aza, שתהיה רק ההתחלה להכירת היהודים מכל הרי ויישובי ישע, which will only be the beginning of the uprooting of Jews from all the cities and towns of Judea and Samaria, והחזרתם ל, in quotes, גבולות Auschwitz, and their return to the borders of Auschwitz, which is a quote from then Foreign Secretary Abba Ibn, who was a member of the Labour Party and certainly not a right winger, when you receive the order that will endanger millions of Jews, remember your oath. That you swore with your induction to the Israeli army to protect the homeland, not to destroy it, to protect the settlers of Israel, the citizens of Israel, not to fight them, and to hit at the enemy, not to aid him. Chayal yakar al ta'ez lahafer et ha-shvua. Dear soldier, don't dare, don't presume to undo this oath. That's one side of the coin. It's not very ambiguous. It's pretty clear where this stands. And by the way, I don't mean to make light of this. This is a very difficult question. Here's the flip side. Chayalim ma'aminim shelo omrim lo. Soldiers who believe that you don't say no. Haschut lechavod v'hachova letzayet. The privilege, the honor, and the obligation to obey. Anu bnei atzionut hadatit. We, the children of religious Zionism, mechuyavim letorah v'ne'emanim lamdina, obligated to Torah and loyal to the state. Einenu yecholim lesarev lehoraat Knesset Yisrael u'mozdoteha hanivcharim. We cannot refuse the orders of the congregation or the gathering of Israel and its chosen elected institutions. Neither can we turn a blind eye to our brothers who are in distress. Anu ponim el hatzibur kulo, and we turn to the entire community. Datiyim v'chilonim, religious and secular, whatever that means. Yemanim u'smolanim, right and left, whatever that means. Lahatot shchem l'shiach achim, to give a shoulder, to make an effort towards dialogue amongst brothers. V'limnoa milchemet achim, and to prevent civil war or war amongst brothers. Benim anu mitnagdim l'hitnatkut o ba'ada, whether we are against disengagement or for it. Aleinu l'askim al klalei ha'mishchak, we must agree on the rules of the game. Aleph, number one, lo l'sarvanut b'mizgeret ha'tzava v'kochot ha'bitachon. No to refusal, in other words, to refuse orders, in the context of the army and the security forces, the police. Lo la'alimut u'laharamat yad al chayalim. No to violence and to lifting a hand against soldiers, one of the fears today. Ken la'afsharuto ha'chukit shel ezrach lavgin ba'ad emdato. But yes to the possibility, legally, for every citizen to demonstrate for his stance, his position. Be'im hinchem maskinim l'kriya zu, and if you agree, add your name. Be'im hinchem muchanim l'tzaref l'ma'avak al atid ha'tzava, and if you're willing to join the battle for the future of the army, the achdut ha'chevra, and the unity of society, ha'israelit, the Israeli society, write us, ki en lanu medina acheret, we have no other state. So when I got these two things in my mailbox, I have to say, normally, you know, you stand there, they're very clever in Efrat. I live in Efrat, in Gush Etzion, in Israel. And they did a very clever thing. They put a large garbage bin near the mailbox. And most people who go pick up their mail, they stand by the mailbox. We don't have like a mailbox in front of the house. There's a central mail area in the shopping center, and that's where you go get your mail. And usually you stand there, and you kind of, you know, junk, junk, spam, junk, junk, and you put it all in the garbage, and it saves a lot of litter. I stood with these two things, and I just stood there thinking, what do you do with this? Which one do you throw in the garbage? What do you do? Very difficult question. Lines being drawn. And part of the question really is, why is this such a significant question? This is not the first time that this question has come up. And I want to try to understand what the basic issues are here. You know, I was recently reading a book, rereading a book by Alan Dershowitz. Maybe some of you read it, Chutzpah. It's well worth reading. There's enough to disagree in with so that you'll really enjoy it. And he describes a meeting that he had with Jan Karski. Jan Karski was a non-Jew who fought in the Polish underground in World War II, who became convinced that the world needed to know of the atrocities that the Jews were experiencing in Poland. So he did the unthinkable. He saw what was going on in Warsaw. He eventually smuggled himself in and out of Belzec, a concentration camp, disguised as a guard. And he reported to the world through various means what was going on. Eventually, he succeeded in smuggling himself out of Europe and made his way to America in 1943. And he had a famous meeting arranged by the Polish ambassador of the Polish government in exile with Justice Frankfurter, Felix Frankfurter, who was one of the members of the Supreme Court. And he described to him, now, Jan Karski was a lawyer, and he had training in legal argument. So this wasn't some peasant who was coming to talk. This was a man speaking on equal ground. And the Polish ambassador was there, and Frankfurter was there, and a couple of other individuals, and he told him everything that he had seen of the mass killings, of the ovens, of the gas chambers, of what it was like to watch 6,000 people being herded onto trains that really were meant to fit 500 to 800. And in the end, after his entire description, Justice Frankfurter, a justice of the Supreme Court, by the way, a Jew, but that's irrelevant for the moment. And you have to understand, this is a man now with the future of the Jewish people in his hands. A justice of the Supreme Court, who, by the way, had Roosevelt's ear. What an opportunity. And he says at the end of this discussion, I believe that we can speak frankly here. I don't believe you. The Polish ambassador in exile, not a Jew, a Pole, was in shock. And he looked at Justice Frankfurter and he said, how can you not believe him after everything you've just heard? How can you call him a liar? And Justice Frankfurter looks at the Polish ambassador in exile and says, I didn't say he's lying. I just said that I can't believe him. My heart and my mind cannot conceive of this as a possibility. Are we entering a similar moment? This is the backdrop to this question. You know, when you struggle with whether or not buses should be closed on Shabbat, should stop running on Shabbat in Israel, when you talk about whether they should outlaw ritual slaughter in America because it might be inhumane, which you can imagine I disagree with, you're talking about a question which is a very significant question. But it's not a question of life or death. It's not a question of existence. The backdrop question to this whole issue, which I'm going to leave you to think about when you leave here tonight, is whether this question is such a question. Are we dealing with a small parcel of land, which at the end of the day, we're going to give back or give away, depending on your political perception? It might cause some difficulties. It might cost a lot of money. It might cause a great deal of pain. But at the end of the day, we'll move on. Or is this somehow the beginning or continuation, as one of these pieces of paper would have us believe, the beginning of the possible end? Are we dealing with the creation of a state that could destroy the state of Israel? And by the way, what would be the implications of the destruction of the state of Israel for Jewry around the world? On two levels. Level number one, which we won't get to tonight, but level number one, the fact that every Jew living anywhere in the world knows that there can never be another Holocaust, God willing, as there was 60 years ago, because we have some place to go. What does it do to us to know that we don't have any place to go? There's an interesting article in the Jerusalem Post this week describing the rise of anti-Semitism in Marseille and in London. And you can look this up, I'm sure it's still on the web. Marseille, on the one hand, experienced an incredible rise, I think something like 300% rise in incidents in anti-Semitism after the year 2000, because of everything going on in Israel, and somehow dealt with it. They found ways to lower it. London, on the other hand, has experienced an extreme rise in anti-Semitism, and it's getting worse. And the pundits are starting to discuss whether or not there's a future for the London Jewish community. To read that being discussed is an amazing thing. And part of this article was a discussion about anti-Semitism in America. Anti-Semitism in America is also on the rise. by leaps and bounds. And one of the reasons it's on the rise is because there now is a dual front of anti-Semitism. Where once anti-Semites were largely on the right, today it's interesting that on the far right you have a little less anti-Semitism, but a whole new front has been opened on the left. Are our days numbered in America? And what would it do to anti-Semitism to watch the state of Israel destroyed, weakened, etc.? So this is a practical issue for the people in this room, not just because we're Jewish, not just because we have an affinity for the state of Israel, but because whether we like it or not, whether we believe it or not, our future is wrapped up with the state of Israel. I remember, this must have been about, 10 years ago. We were in the middle of the first Intifada. And we showed up, we had a reserve duty, and we were going, I think we were going to Ramallah, to El Amri, to a particular refugee camp in Ramallah. And, none of us were exactly looking forward to it. The first day of reserve duty, the way it works usually is that on the first day, everybody gets together, you collect. We were meeting in a base called Beit Jubrin, which is a base where you do 2 or 3 days training. The Israeli army by this time had learned its lessons from the beginning of the Intifada, and they decided that combat troops needed a certain amount of training before they were going to come into contact with the civilian population. And so they train you in all sorts of, how to use weapons that are nonviolent, or at least weapons that are not deadly, how to use gas grenades, tear gas, what to do when there are women and children, and all these types of things. And as soon as you were called, and you got your reserve duty notice, and they told you to report to Beit Jubrin, so you knew that you weren't going to, to a quiet zone, you were going to the Intifada. And one of the nastier parts of Miluim was the first day of reserve duty, because if you're an officer, you're part of the process of, all the guys who show up and want to get out of reserve duty. My wife, my business, my this, I can't do the whole time, can I get these days? And, you have to do whatever you do. And usually you call up more guys than you need, because not everybody shows up, and that may be the problem of the army, and they follow up on it, but you, the first day of your reserve duty, you can't afford to wait until they show up. You have to be sure you have enough men to man whatever you're doing. So one fellow comes to Miluim and announces that he's not going to Ramallah. He refuses to go. He's willing to do his reserve duty, but he's not willing to go to Ramallah. So I said to him, listen, that's where we're going. He said, well, send me somewhere else. I can't send somewhere else. You're part of our unit, and that's where we're going. He said, I'm not going to Ramallah. I said, why are you not going to Ramallah? He said, because I didn't sign up to be a policeman. I'm a combat soldier. Send me to Lebanon. Send me to Syria. But I don't want to be dealing with women and children throwing rocks. It's not what I want to do. And I believe it's wrong, and I believe it's illegal, and I don't believe we should be doing it, and you can imagine. So I had a discussion with the battalion commander, and we didn't know what to do. Here's a guy who's misarep kuda. He's refusing an order. Now, you can throw him in jail, technically, legally. But he's married. He's got a family. He's got children. And the truth is that we had 20 more guys than we needed. So we did something that I'm not sure was the right thing to do. We just let him go. We said, look, we're not interested in having you in our unit in Ramallah if we have to force you to be there. The things we're going to do are challenging enough. We need to know that whoever's there is there. So if you don't want to serve, fine, you'll get another reserve duty. It's not worth our time. We disagree with you. And whatever other consequences came as a result in his file and whatever else it might be. And I look back on that now, and I wonder, did we do the right thing? Now, granted, it was the battalion commander's decision, but a very difficult question. Does a soldier have the right to refuse an order? What allows a soldier to refuse an order? When can you refuse an order? When can you not refuse an order? So I want to share with you basically 5 pieces to this question. And first, I just want to tell you 2 things. It is not possible, at least for me, to get into this discussion without at least getting into a little bit the halachic implications. Halacha is the Jewish legal system that has been with us for 2,000 years. It's not an ancient system of law. It's a living, vibrant, evolving system that's based on a tradition that we received 3,000 years ago. The halachic questions here are very complex. And I want you to understand that not only did I not come here to give halachic rulings, but I'm myself not a posek. I'm not interested in being a posek. I don't want to rule halachically. So nobody should walk away from this discussion thinking that you now know the halacha, the traditional law on this topic. It's a very complex series of discussions. So what we will do is I'm going to raise some of the issues. And I'm willing even to tell you at the end my personal opinion, but I don't want anybody here to view this as halacha. It's a very complicated question. In fact, one of the struggles that soldiers, and particularly officers like me, have is this a question that I feel I have to ask a greater halakhic authority than me? Or dafka, is this an issue that I have to struggle with myself? Which is a very difficult question. So that's the first thing. I'm not giving you halakhic rulings. The second thing is that there are certain facts that I think that we need to know in order to at least be informed on the topic. And there are really five pieces, as I mentioned before, to this discussion. So the first thing is, you know, what's the political background, the historical background? What is the plan? What exactly is going on? You know, and I wouldn't have thought to bring this up, except that on the plane over here, I actually had a discussion with a fellow from Brooklyn who had been visiting Israel, and he doesn't really understand exactly what the disengagement plan is. And sometimes you live so deeply in a situation that you forget that people who live overseas, maybe you're busy and don't always have time, blessedly, to spend half their day on the news, you know, might not have all the facts. So let me give you 3 minutes of the basic facts. What does this mean, the disengagement plan? In 1947, and I'm going to have great difficulty discussing this without, on some level, sharing a political bent, which is not normally the nature of what we do at Israelite, what I personally do. You know, I'm very obviously subjective on this topic, and the ideal would actually be for there to be a panel discussion up here, but, you know, there's a limit to how much time you have in a given evening. In 1917, in the middle of World War I, the British conquered this particular area of the Middle East that we call Israel, that was then called Palestine, from the Turks. And they came and found a mess. The Arabs had been promised by the British an Arab state. The Jews had been promised in 1913 by Lord Balfour, who was then the Secretary of Britain, the Foreign Secretary, I believe, that His Majesty's government views with favor the establishment of a Jewish state on her ancient homeland. This was a tremendous boon. They get to Israel, they finally take it over, and they realize it's not so simple. So they're given a mandate by the League of Nations, which was the predecessor of the UN, to see if they could fix it, clean it up. It took them 30 years and no small amount of resistance to realize that it wasn't so easy. So eventually in 1947, they handed it back to the United Nations. The United Nations sent a fact-finding mission. They had some research done, and eventually they took what everybody knows was a significant vote historically. On November 29th, 1947, the United Nations voted to partition the area that we call Palestine into two states, a Jewish state and an Arab state. Jewish state, the Jews agreed to this partition plan, albeit with a very heavy heart, because it didn't include some major sections of Jewish settlement, most notably Gush Etzion, Yerushalayim, or particularly the Old City. However, for 2,000 years, the Jews had been dreaming of this. The Arabs, on the other hand, did not accept the partition plan for various reasons that we won't get into tonight. And they vowed to fight this decision. The British announced that as a result of the UN decision, they were going to leave Palestine. They'd had enough. And they announced that they would be leaving on May 14th, 1948. The Jews announced that on the day the British left, because they couldn't do this until the British were gone, because technically it was British sovereign territory, they announced that on the day the British left, they would declare a state of Israel. The Arabs announced that this would be the shortest-lived state in the history of the world, because as soon as the British left and the Israelis or Jews declared their state, the Arab armies would march. There were 7 Arab armies basically surrounding the state of Israel. They could not attack until the British left, because if they attacked before the British left, they'd be attacking British sovereign territory, which would basically mean declaring war on Britain. And therefore, everybody knew that May 14th was not going to be a pleasant day. And there was a whole discussion. It was originally May 15th, fine. The Jews declared in 1948 their state. The Arabs attacked. The War of Independence ensued. Over the next year and a half, Israel lost over 1% of its population, which would be the equivalent of 3.5 million Americans being killed, God forbid, in the next year. 6,000 Israelis were killed. It was the most costly of all of Israel's wars. In 1950, and I'll spare you the details, if you come to Israel with us, you'll get a chance to see this firsthand. In 1950, the Israelis, brokered through the UNs, finally sat with Egypt, with Jordan, with Syria, and declared a ceasefire. They did not declare peace, but they declared a ceasefire. One of the results of the war of 1948 was that over 1 million Arabs found themselves homeless. Now, why they found themselves homeless is an interesting discussion. Is it because Arab armies said, get out of the way so that we can come in and conquer with impunity and then you'll come back and join it? Is it because Israeli army units went into Arab villages and kicked them out? Is it because, which I think was the majority of the case, Arabs were terrified because the war zone was coming in their direction? But be it as it may, in 1948, large portions of Arab villages were abandoned. Arabs fled over the borders. Israel, for various reasons, declared the borders closed. And as a result, the refugee problem emerged. Now, there were three refugee problems that the world was struggling with in the Middle East at that time. One of them was the Jewish refugees in Europe. There were over 2 million Jews that were wallowing in the camps, in the DP camps. The second was the refugee problem from Arab lands, because as the war of 1948 went on and it was clear that Israel was not going to be destroyed, the Arabs took out their wrath on Jewish communities in 22 countries in the Middle East, and the Jews basically had to flee with their shirts on their backs. 850,000 Jews came to the state of Israel by hook, by crook, by secret plane, by treks through the desert, and by bribery between 1951 and 1954. That more than doubled the population. That would be the equivalent today of President Bush standing up and announcing that by the year 2008, we're going to bring 400 million, Mexicans into the country. That would be unbelievable. And in fact, there were tent cities all over the country for the next 15 years until finally enough housing was built. The second stage of this discussion that leads to this political reality is 1967. In 1967, okay, this is a two-minute summation, of a year's college course that, is worth taking. In April, May of 1967, Jamal Abdel Nasser, who was the president of Egypt, not exactly a friend to Israel, closed the Straits of Tehran. This was against a UN agreement. This was a violation of international law. Straits of Tehran are basically a water channel that allow Israel shipping from, North Africa, among other places, to arrive at the coastal port of Eilat. They closed the Straits of Tehran. They kicked out the UN observers from the Sinai, which is the desert south of what is today Israel. And they massed armies on Israel's border. Syria did the same thing. Over the course of the next 5 weeks, almost the entire Israeli army reserve was called up. If you've got 330,000 Egyptian troops massing on your border, you need to kind of upgrade the normal 1,800 men that hold the border. So Israel called up its reserves. Now, of course, the problem is that Israel is a small country. In 1967, Israel was not even 20 years old. The amount of money, cost, manpower that it takes to hold the Israeli army reserve, the major part of the Israeli army is not the standing army. I'm not going to get into the numbers, especially since I'm taping this, because I don't think that's a wise thing to do. But, the reserve Israeli army outnumbers the regular army by 5 to 6 times. And that's really the main army is meant to hold the line until the reserves can be called up, which, by the way, was why Yom Kippur was such a frightening experience. After about a month of this, with the radio waves in Arab countries filled with, destroying the Jews and pushing them into the sea, Israel finally decided enough was enough, without getting into all the politics, and decided to attack before they were attacked. And on the morning of June 6, 1967, the Israeli Air Force basically crossed the border, headed south into Egypt, and in two sorties took out 80% of the Egyptian Air Force on the ground. They then took out 60% of the Syrian Air Force on the ground, and by the end of the first day, the war was already won. The rest of the 5 days of the Six-Day War was basically mopping up. In the Six-Day War, the three significant events that are going to lead up to our discussion were, first of all, that we took the Golan Heights. Syria had been bombarding, Israel and the Israeli settlements underneath the Golan almost continuously for the previous 19 years. A delegation of Israeli citizens finally went to Levi Eshkol, who was the prime minister, and demanded that this was finally the time to end this. The second event was, of course, the taking of Yerushalayim, specifically East Jerusalem and the Old City, and all of Judea and Samaria, so that the border now became a straight line through the Jordan Valley. If you're not sure what I mean, we can do this some other time with a map. And the third event, which is going to bring us specifically to what we're talking about now, was the area of the Gaza Strip. The Gaza Strip lies, if you think about the coastal region of Israel, so imagine that this is the map, and here is Haifa, and here is Netanya, and Herzliya, and Tel Aviv, and Rishon LeZion, right? And down here below Rehovot come the cities of Ashkelon and Ashdod, and below Ashkelon and Ashdod is a strip known as the Gaza Strip, specifically the city of Gaza, or Gaza in English, which leads down south of Gaza to Rafiah. The then 600,000 Arabs that populated this area now came under Israeli control. This was in 1967. In 1973, in the war of 1973, by the way, just as an aside, it's very interesting that when Egypt attacked, we actually know that Egypt had no interest in taking back the Gaza Strip. This came out in the peace discussions with Begin and Sadat. In fact, there was a whole dialogue post-1978 when the Camp David Accords were signed between Begin, Sadat, and Carter, because Begin wanted to make peace on condition that we give back the Gaza Strip, right? And Sadat was willing to make peace on condition that he doesn't have to take back the Gaza Strip. And the border today of Egypt and Israel actually runs through the city of Rafiah. There's an area called Rafiah HaMitzri, Egyptian Rafiah, which is the south. And there's Rafiah HaIsraeli, which is the north. And, you know, I've seen press articles that discuss the fact that, you know, we should have given the Gaza Strip to Egypt, and why do we want to retain control? And the truth is, we would love nothing better than to give the whole area back to Egypt, or at least most of it. And that brings us up to the current day. Today there are approximately 1.1 million, the numbers vary, Arabs, living in the area that we call the Gaza Strip. I'm going to put aside for the moment the question of the northern Shomron and the particular Arab cities that are part of this disengagement plan, and we'll just talk about Gaza. And if we get to it in the Q&A, we can talk about it later. As a result of the Oslo Accords, the Palestinian Authority was created, and one of the two areas, which was the original experiment that Yitzhak Rabin decided to implement, in fact, the slogan that went around Israel was Gaza v'Yericho Tchila, Nisayon Gaza v'Yericho Tchila, the experiment of first giving over control of Gaza and Jericho, right, was an attempt to first give them municipal control with an eye towards eventually giving them security control. Originally they were joint security ventures, etc. Right? And that was an experiment that began in 1993. By the year 2000, this experiment had completely unraveled. The joint security patrols between Arabs and Israelis, Palestinians and Israelis, fell apart. And as a result of the previous 7 years of Palestinian Authority rule, infrastructure, terror cells, etc., had developed to such a point that the previous smaller cells had now reached the size of battalions. Now you need to understand this as an aside, and I'm going to give you 3 more minutes and then we'll get into the issue. Prior to Oslo, and by the way, I'm not commenting on whether Oslo was right or wrong. It's a very difficult question. On the one hand, many people had hesitations. On the other hand, you take risks for war. Do you have to take risks for peace? It's very easy to talk with hindsight. I'm one of those who was very, very nervous about the Oslo Accords, but who dared to dream that maybe it could be. Who are we to know? But I'm looking now with hindsight, which is always easier. Prior to 1993, when you talked about a terrorist cell in Beit Lahem, Gaza, Hebron, you were talking about 3, 5, 8, a squad. If you discovered a terrorist cell that involved 20 people, which was already a machlaka, almost a platoon, that was a huge cell. Because the Israeli army's security was good, because we had a lot of intelligence, because there were many informants, and because the larger a cell gets, the more probable it is that it's going to leak out. And one of the most important implications of that is that Arabs could only train in small groups. Now, when you can only train in small groups, then all you can really do is terror. You can't mount an operation against an Israeli army brigade if you can only train in groups of 5 or 10. However, as a result of the Oslo Accords, sometimes under the guise of the Palestinian Authority, the Palestinian police, separate cells, Hamas, whatever it might be. I know in our area, already in 94, 95, especially in the summer, we started hearing all this shooting at night. All the time shooting at night. There were different rumors that came out. You know, first we thought it was weddings. When Arabs have weddings, at least outside of like central cities, so you and I celebrate by having a band. They can't afford a band, so they, you know, that's what they do. They shoot their guns up in the air. And by the way, I'm not, you know, different cultures, different pieces. You know, you want to shoot your gun in the air, that's your business. But there were just too many weddings going on. It was just a little... And finally, you know, we started to realize, I mean, they were basically training. They'd erected training grounds and they'd erected firing ranges, etc. Today, you have at least 9 Palestinian brigades that have trained in brigade force. Right? And most notably is this the case in the Gaza Strip. After 2000, the issues that Jews in the Gaza Strip were dealing with began to escalate. They went from the occasional terrorist trying to cut his way under the wire into a greenhouse to mortar fire, got some rocket fire, regular terrorism, etc. Which leaves us with the challenge that the Israeli army and the political arm behind the Israeli army has been facing for the last 4 years. So what do you do about that? I'm not commenting for the moment on right, wrong, land, give, not. We're going to get to that. But first, just to understand the problem. In other words, to sit here and talk about whether the land is sanctified and whether we should give it away or not give it away, first you have to understand that a politician struggling with this issue is trying to figure out how to stop missiles being fired over the border into Sderot, which is, by the way, over the Green Line, and in, I hate to use the term proper Israel, because that's a very loaded term, whatever, but everybody understands what I mean. Places that we would never have thought. So what's the most obvious response, which is very easy, you know, sitting with the New York Times in one hand and your cup of coffee in the other, is, well, that's what we have an army for. So if they shoot missiles at our women and children, we have to send the army in. But of course, there's a price for that. Because every time you send the army in, the boys don't always all come back. Nowhere was this more true than Gaza. Very difficult area. I remember in 1988, I did a month of reserve duty in Jabalia, which is the worst refugee camp in the Gaza Strip. It was absolutely the most horrible milieu I ever did. You walk around a corner and there's 500-600 people and you're a 12-man patrol and every alleyway and every nook and every cranny, very, very difficult. There's a live border with Egypt. And you have to understand, normally, you know, in some areas, so the border is a desert. So you have a fence or you don't have a fence. But in Rafiah, so, you know, here's the Israeli side of the border. And here's the Egyptian side of the border. And here's a, you know, a couple of fences in the middle. So what do you have to do? You just dig a tunnel and the ground is very soft. It's all sand. It takes about 3 days to dig a tunnel from there to there. How do you dig a tunnel and not get noticed? It's very simple. You send a message to the person who has a house over here. You tell them, listen, we're going to dig a tunnel up through your house. When you hear us digging up, let us in. Because if you don't, we're going to kill you and your wife and your children. Oh, thank you so much. So you dig a tunnel. You tell this fellow he has no choice. I'm not getting into the politics, the plus, the con, what to do. That's just the reality. Every time they find a tunnel, they dig 2 more. Because it's so easy to dig these tunnels, very difficult. So the situation is very complicated. So, you know, you have some who say, well, listen, you know, you're fighting a war. And you can't win a war by negotiating. First you have to win a war, then you negotiate. And then you have those who say, that's all well and good, but we're tired of bringing our boys home in body bags. So this is a very complex question. I remember in 95, the Yeshuv of Nitzarim, which is amongst all the settlements in the Gaza Strip, probably the most difficult to defend. It sits right in the middle of Gaza. I mean, it's, you know, the distance between the fence of Nitzarim and Gaza itself is like from here to that door. And one day it came under attack, which was unbelievable. It wasn't that it came under attack from a lone terrorist. Mobs tried to overrun it. And the fellow actually who I was working with at the time, who was on reserve duty, who was the commander of the position that was attached to Nitzarim, fellow named Mayor Kraus, they basically fought a pitched battle for 3 days until reinforcements could find their way to them. So here lies the complication. Where do your responsibilities lie? The lives of your soldiers, the lives of your citizens, the violence in the region. So someone came up with an interesting idea. You know, if you have a classroom and the boys can't get along, sometimes what you have to do is you have to kick one out. Pull one out and put him in the other class. It's a reasonable possibility. So, if we can't negotiate a peace, if they won't make peace with us based on equal terms, we don't want to be patrolling Gaza. When I say we, I'm talking about the position. I'm not telling you what I think of this. So let's just leave. Instead of having a border in and out and around, instead of having to protect each town and each village, let's pull out, make a wall, leave them on that side of the wall, we'll be on this side of the wall, and then the borders are very clear. The only problem with this, of course, is that you can't make such a wall in between the Jews that live in Gaza and the Arabs. If this was the Gaza Strip and all the Jews lived up top, that'd be easy. But the Jews live here, and Gaza is here. So you can't really do it. So the only way to do this, really, if you want to disengage, if you want to pull out, if you want to create a border you can live with, is to uproot 8,000 Jews from their homes. And the question is that right? Do you pay the price? What do you do? But that's not really the full question we're going to deal with. Because the full question we're going to deal with is not really whether that's a bright idea or not a bright idea, although afterwards in the Q&A we can get into it. But even if you assume it's a terrible idea, even if you assume that it's theologically misguided, let's assume for the moment that the Israeli government decides to do it. And you are given an order, as an officer, to go into Netzarim and to order these Jews to leave their homes. Are you allowed to do that? Should you refuse? Now, this is very complicated, and we're going to get into why. But that's the first detail. Just the facts on the ground. The basic plan that Ariel Sharon has outlined is that within the year, and there's much debate about the dates, so we won't get into that, the Israeli army basically is going to forcibly uproot, hopefully not forcibly, but that's of course the question in the press, the Jews who are living in the Gaza Strip, create a clearly defined border, do the same for some of the yeshuvim that are in the northern area of Shomron. There's an Arab area called the Mishulash, the triangle. Afterwards, if you're curious to how that works, you can ask me. And by pulling out and disengaging and creating clear borders, we will solve military, strategic, and various other problems. We will gain much in the eyes of the world, supposedly. We will save a fortune every year. Most notably, less soldiers will be put in danger. And this will be the beginning of our ability to create a negotiating stance with the Arabs. That's the plan. And that's question number one. Point number two, again, just in the interest of sort of getting the facts out there, is this area different from Tel Aviv? Is it different from Yerushalayim? Now this is an interesting question. In 1982, as a result of the Camp David Accords, Israel agreed to pull out of the entire Sinai. Included in that Sinai area was a small area, relatively, of Jewish settlement, which included various towns, Yamit, Atzmona. Begin wanted to be able to leave those Jewish settlers, the word settler is a very loaded word. Somebody comes up with a good definition for settler that differentiates someone who lives in Yamit from someone who lives in Tel Aviv, you'll let me know. But okay, but for the purpose of the newspaper articles that we seem to have become accustomed to. So the Jews who were living in Yamit and Atzmona, Begin wanted them to be able to stay. The Jews who lived there, by the way, themselves said they didn't want to stand in the way of peace. Egypt, Cairo, was hundreds and hundreds of miles away. There were no Egyptians living around them. There were no Arabs living around them. I went to visit Yamit a few times, not, by the way, for any political reason, but because I had a good friend who lived there, and I got to stay in a house which was a 5-minute walk from the beach, which when you're in yeshiva is a great opportunity. So I would go to visit him on Friday morning, and we would hang out at the beach all Friday afternoon, long stretches of empty beaches, nobody for miles, no Arabs, no Jews, nobody. In fact, I remember thinking to myself, why would anybody want to live in the desert, except for the fact that it's on the beach? Okay. Sadat's response to this is recorded, if we sign this accord and you want peace with Egypt, the Sinai will be Judenrein. Those were his words. When someone says that to you, sitting in the Oval Office of the White House, there's really not much room for negotiation. So agree, disagree, that's what Begin agreed to. And this is a very difficult stance to take. one of the big questions that arose in the time of Yamit was, is the Sinai and is Yamit really part of Israel? Was it really part of Israel? Or is it further south than the traditional Israeli borders? And this became an important question, because if it's not part of Israel, then there's no halachic problem, according to anybody, Jewish traditional problem, with giving away that land. Right? If we had Jews living in Borough Park, and the Palestinians said, we'll make peace with you on condition that you pull Jews out of Borough Park, right? There wouldn't be a halachic problem, wouldn't be any Jewish traditional problem with pulling Jews out of Borough Park. You would go to the Jews of Borough Park and you would say, listen, you know, we're gonna move you to Teaneck now. Nebuch. Boca Raton, right? So if you were living in Borough Park and somebody says, listen, we're gonna pay you so you can move to Boca Raton, okay, no problem. You can imagine the scene of pulling screaming women out of Borough Park to send them to Boca Raton, but okay. But if Yamit is part of the land of Israel, so that's a more complicated question. 2,000 years we dreamed of settling the land of Israel. Are we allowed to just give it away? Is it ours to give away? So the first question is it part of Israel? Because if it's not part of Israel, this isn't an issue. And there was some debate about the question of Yamit. The traditional halachic opinion, by the way, is very clear that Yamit, in fact, at Tzmona, that area was part of Israel. It was part of ancient Israel, part of biblical Israel, part of our return to Israel. However, because the government assumed in their negotiations that it was not part of traditional Israel, that changed the political reality. In other words, the fact that they had the assumption that they were giving back an area that wasn't traditionally part of biblical Israel made for a different stance. However, in the case of Aza, that's not the case. We're not going to get deep into this question. This is a sheer discussion in and of itself. Take it from me. The area of Aza is pretty much agreed upon, was part of biblical Israel. Jews settled there. There are, by the way, two issues that are worth mentioning when it comes to the definition of a place as the land of Israel. The first is fascinating, comes from the Rambam. The Rambam, Maimonides, makes a very interesting point, and I wish we had the time to get into this text, but the Rambam says that there are two kedushot. There are two sanctities. There's the sanctity of Jerusalem, where the Mikdash, where the temple was, and that's forever. And there's the sanctity of Kibush Yoshua, of the conquest of Yoshua. The areas of land outside of Jerusalem, all over the country that Joshua conquered, where we lived for nearly 1,000 years, where David built his city, where we conquered the Philistines, where the 12 tribes made their land, where we lived until the destruction of the first temple in 586 before the Common Era. So you're talking about 800 years. That sanctity only lasted as long as the Jews lived there. The sanctity of the land of Israel is not sanctity all on its own. The sanctity of the land of Israel is only sanctified because Jews live in the land. If Jews are not living in the land of Israel, there's no sanctity to it. That's what the Rambam says. However, in the time of Ezra, at the beginning of the second temple, when the Jews began to come home after the destruction of the first temple and the rebuilding of the second, all the places, says Maimonides, and I'll share you what this is based on, but it's not only Maimonides, all of the places that the Jews returned to became re-sanctified. And when they became re-sanctified, they became re-sanctified forever. Why? Because if you lose a lost object, there's a law in the Talmud, right, in Bava Metzia. Imagine that I lose a watch. And I lose it on the subway in New York City. And you find it. Are you allowed to keep it? Now it's my watch. Are you allowed to keep it? Right? So the reason you're allowed to keep it is because the assumption is that a watch lost on the subway in New York, whoever had the watch, as soon as he discovers that he's lost it, is going to have yeush. He's going to give up on ever finding it. That process, mentally, of giving up on ever finding it, means I've given up on it, it's not mine, and therefore you can keep it. So when we lost the land of Israel, we gave up on it. But when we came back and reestablished a home there, we demonstrated effectively that we'd never given up on it. And that's why any place the Jews come back to is a living demonstration that we've never given up hope on this land, and therefore that land reacquires forever the sanctity of the land of Israel. And so Aza is part of the land of Israel, not only because it was traditionally part of the land of Israel, but precisely because Jews came and resettled the land, both in the time of the Hashmonaim and Hanukkah, and again later post-67. So technically that's the first issue. The second issue is a little more complicated. It has to do with whether things are conquered as tribes or as individuals. And again, when we get to the Q&A, if you're curious, you can ask me. So let's assume for the moment that Aza and the Gaza Strip and these settlements are in fact part of the land of Israel. So that giving them up or giving them away is giving away a portion that traditionally is part of the land of Israel, the homeland of the Jewish people. Okay, question is, can you do that? Right? So that is the second issue. In other words, if this is the land of Israel, can you in fact give it up?